Hi, this is Tyson Brown with NSTA Press. This marks our fourth installment of NSTA Press Behind the Book. Today I'm talking with Paige Keeley, author of Uncovering Student Ideas in Science, Volume 1, a book that will help you pinpoint what your students know so you can monitor their learning and adjust your teaching accordingly. Paige, welcome.
Thanks, Tyson. I'm really happy to be here and not stranded at the Denver airport in that terrible blizzard.
Great.
First of all, I want to thank you and NSTA for giving me this opportunity to share some work that's very near and dear to my practice as a former science teacher.
Paige, why do you think there is such a need for this sort of book?
First of all, I think it's important to note that the assessment landscape is changing in schools quite considerably, and more teachers are becoming aware of how students learn and the integral role that assessment plays in promoting learning and good teaching practice. There's some terrific research publications that have become accessible to teachers that are guiding teaching and learning, like How People Learn, which is a great resource that points out the importance of identifying students' preconceptions. I think we've come to accept that teaching doesn't always result in learning if we don't take the time to uncover students' thinking. A Maine teacher recently shared this constructivist teacher's joke with me. He said, well, I had a great lesson, but the wrong class showed up. And that's great. And I think this illustrates that, you know, having great activities and materials in the classroom, you know, by themselves, they don't result in learning unless we take into account that students have these firmly held ideas in science and, you know, we take the time to identify what they are. I think that more and more teachers are recognizing that assessment is more than just testing. But the problem is that, as you know, many instructional materials lack good formative assessments and the type of questions that are designed to uncover students' ideas.
What do you mean by commonly held ideas?
Well, by commonly held ideas, I mean misconceptions, and I use that word in a very general way, that research has shown that students are very likely to have, regardless of whether they're students in Maine or California or Spain or Israel or anywhere. And a lot of the assessment items that are available to teachers come from their materials that they're using, or a lot of teachers use released state test items. But it's important to note that these kinds of questions that teachers use typically are not designed to surface the commonly held ideas, misconceptions. So linking back to that previous question that you asked me, designing a really good probing question, it's not an easy task, and there is definitely a need for a bank of formative assessment items that busy teachers can use that will uncover these commonly held ideas so they can get valuable information about their students' thinking. So that's what my co-authors, Frances Eberle and Lynn Farron and myself, have done by providing this book.
Why are preconceptions and misconceptions so difficult to dislodge?
There isn't a really simple, quick answer to this. First, we need to recognize that children they're such active learners, and they're constantly constructing ideas about the natural world just from the things around them. And they pick up so many of their ideas from outside of school as well as inside the classroom. So it's really difficult to change these ideas when they are things that are not always happening right there in the science classroom. They form very early on in some cases, and often it's years later until they become challenged in the science classroom. And unfortunately, sometimes those ideas go unchallenged throughout the grades. So preconceived ideas make a lot of sense to students, and that's why they tend to hold on to them. And until they have some kind of experience that makes them question their own ideas, then they can be very persistent all the way up through the grades. I mean, some very simple ideas that kids form in elementary school will persist all the way through high school and adulthood. Well, for example, you're probably familiar with some of the research on the phases of the moon.
Sure.
Yeah, and, you know, many adults, if you ask many adults what causes the phases of the moon, they think that it's a shadow that's blocking the light that's reflected from the moon. And actually, they often even lack this conception of light reflection. So that could be an idea that was formed very early on, and even though they learned about the phases of the moon in school, and they may have been taught about the Earth, Moon, Sun position, if that idea of the shadow was never surfaced, those students will continue to hold on to that idea well into adulthood, as we know when we ask adults that question.
Paige, are misconceptions something that all students hold?
Absolutely. Sometimes we think that some of our brightest students are the ones who don't have misconceptions, but often they're the ones who have some very significant misconceptions, and they're the ones who are really good at giving the right answers on a test, but yet we know that they will revert right back to their misconceptions, which also points out that, you know, merely correcting a misconception that a student has is not going to change their ideas in the long run. Students need to have opportunities to discover for themselves when their ideas are not working for them.
Well, you call the assessments in the book probes. What is a probe?
I decided to call them probes because that's exactly what they do. They probe. And not all assessments teachers use probe. Many just ask for recall of factual information. But what's interesting is I looked up the Webster's general definition of a probe, and it was described as a device that is inserted into something and gives back useful information. So I guess that is what a probe does.
Can you give me an example of a probe that promotes thinking?
Oh, there's a great one called Gazing at the Moon. I'm not going to put you on the spot, but I'm going to ask you this question and have you think about it. And it's a question about a student in the Northern Hemisphere in Boston who's looking at the moon one night and sees a full moon. And then their friend down at the tip of South America is looking at the same moon on the same evening. So the question asks, you know, what their friend in South America would see. Well, I'm not going to embarrass you, Tyson. But
well, let me go ahead and reveal my ignorance and say that I would guess they see the same thing.
Well, good for you. They would see the same moon. You actually see the same moon wherever you are on the Earth. But what's really interesting about this question, because you sort of have to go deeper into, oh, you know, understanding the phases of the moon is more than just knowing the names of the phases and knowing more than just memorizing a definition of what causes the phases of the moon. Actually, as you start to think about it, many students confuse that question with their understanding of seasons. And because it's a question that asks students to think about what they would see in the southern hemisphere, well, they start thinking about this opposite conception. And so, actually, we have looked at hundreds and hundreds of student papers from elementary, middle, and high school, and I would say about 80% of students pick the new moon, and they use that opposite conception, because that's what they've learned when they were taught about the seasons, that the seasons are the opposite in the southern hemisphere. Therefore, they use a similar line of reasoning that, oh, well, the phases of the moon must be opposite as well. So if you see a new moon in the north, then you must see a full moon in the south, or vice versa.
Can you use the probes in every state?
Oh, absolutely. The probes actually address important ideas in science that cut across multiple grade levels. So they're neither specific to any state standard or any grade level, and that's what makes them so flexible, that they're applicable to a variety of grade levels and state standards. But what's important to remember is that not all state standards include every important idea in science. There are a lot of other ideas that need to be assessed that will contribute to students' understanding of the ideas in their standards. For example, almost every state has standards about matter. Changes in matter, states of matter, properties of matter, conservation of matter. It's matter, matter, matter. You see that term everywhere in state standards. But do you think students have ever been asked what their conception of matter is?
Mm-hmm.
And I've looked through assessment questions, and there are no standards that specifically ask students what matter is. So there's a probe in the book called Is It Matter? That does this by presenting students with a list of things and asking them to check off the things on the list that are considered to be matter.
Right.
And what's really interesting is that looking at hundreds of papers again from elementary, middle, and high school, very few students check off air.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yet, they can recite back a textbook definition of matter. You know, matter is anything that has mass and occupies space. Yet, they fail to check off things like air, steam, dissolved sugar, even atoms. So you can see how an assessment probe like this would be a prerequisite that you would use before you, you know, even teach ideas that are related to the topic of matter.
Speaking to those basic understandings.
Yeah.
How would a teacher incorporate probes into his or her curriculum?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that question, because first of all, a teacher needs to have a purpose for using a probe. And if that purpose is to find out what students' initial ideas are in order for them to plan instruction, then a teacher might give the probe several days in advance of a lesson, and this would give the teacher time to analyze the results and plan a sequence of lessons that will build that bridge between where their students are when they start and the learning goal that includes the ideas that you want students to achieve. But they can also be used as discussion prompts. I mean, they're wonderful questions to have students talk about their ideas in small groups or even with the whole class. And we know that providing time for students to talk through their ideas helps them formulate and revise their thinking. But another way they can be used is as inquiry starters. Many of the probes lend themselves to a test of students' ideas. One other way you can use them is at the end as a reflection. I encourage teachers to collect the probes after the students have taken them at the beginning and go through their responses, set them aside, and then at the end of a sequence of lessons, return them to the students and have students look at what their additional ideas were. And you see a lot of big ahas when students recognize how much their ideas have changed from what their original preconceptions were. And that kind of ties back to an important principle in how people learn, the importance of metacognition, when students recognize that, wow, I really think differently now. I really learned something.
I'll bet.
Yeah.
Just coming to that sort of awareness is an important part of learning.
Absolutely. It's really hard sometimes to distinguish the use of probes as an assessment item from an instructional technique or strategy. I mean, the instruction and assessment, those two things are so inextricably tied together. But I think a really important thing to mention, and I emphasize this in the book and with teachers, is that these probes should not be used as quiz or test items, and they shouldn't be graded. We need to remember that these are formative assessments that are used to inform teaching and promote thinking.
Would you have an example of how a teacher might change her approach based on the feedback a probe elicits?
The probe, can it reflect light? I believe that's one of the examples that you have up on the NSTA website that teachers can access. That's a probe where students are given a set of items and they're asked to check off the things that can reflect light. Now, what's interesting is when I put together the list, I put together a list of things that were shiny and smooth and things that were rough and dull. So you'd see things like mirrors and glass and white paper and rough cardboard and tarnished pennies and so on. But what's interesting is when you look at the student work and you read their reasons for selecting the item, they tend to choose things that are shiny and smooth, like mirrors. And their reasoning is that in order to reflect light, it needs to be shiny or it needs to be smooth. So that right away is a red flag to the teacher that he or she needs to include other examples besides mirrors or smooth, shiny objects in the activities that students use to learn about light reflection, so that students develop this generalized notion that every object reflects light if you can see it. And that ties to the idea that in order to see an object, light reflected from it must enter your eye. So that's a big aha to teachers too, you know, thinking about how to connect the idea of how we see objects from reflected light to, you know, just learning about what light reflection is and how objects reflect light. So that was a big eye opener for teachers who've used that probe to see that, you know, it's more than just designing activities that use mirrors.
And I think it also underscores the formative nature of these probes, in the sense that even if you include more of those selections, the students would still gravitate toward the shiny and the smooth initially.
Yeah.
But then you'd circle them back.
Absolutely. So when you see that initially they choose those, it just makes you more aware that you've got to provide experiences that confront them with the idea that dull and rough objects also reflect light. So, you know, if you didn't give a probe and if you didn't realize that this is an idea that students hold, then you might open up your book or your materials might have an activity that uses mirrors to teach about light reflection. And, you know, right away, students are bound by that context and right, they don't develop the idea that, well, you know, other objects reflect light as well.
How would you like teachers to use this book?
I want them to enjoy the wonder of discovering their own students' thinking. I think when teachers use the probes, it excites them to want to know more about what students think and what they can do to help move their students towards developing the scientific ideas. But I also want teachers to be deliberate when they use the probes. You need to use them when they're most needed, and don't waste them by using them as sort of a trivia question of the week. You know, they're so powerful that they should be there when that teachable moment comes along. I'd also like to see teachers share these with their colleagues, particularly the student work that they collect. You know, there's so much more to learn about students and how they learn best when teachers collaborate and examine student thinking together. And don't forget the teacher notes. The teacher notes contain so much valuable information about unpacking the standards and the research on student learning, and teachers find that they often hold some of the same misconceptions that their students have.
Paige, thanks so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to talk to me today. For more information about Uncovering Student Ideas in Science, Volume 1, including a thorough introduction to the assessment concepts presented in the book, and a sample physical science assessment probe, Can It Reflect Light, go to www.nsta.org and click on the Science Store. This is Tyson Brown, signing off from NSTA Press.